Welcome to Sputnik, orbiting the world with me, George Galloway.
And me, Gayatri. 500 years of Western domination of the globe is rapidly coming to a close, accelerated by the great decoupling underway due to events in Ukraine.
The West, it should be remembered, constitutes just 10% of the population of the actual world, though history has schooled that 10% into believing that they are the international community.
In truth, the West is the periphery of the new Eurasia, now clearly visible through the fog of war and disinformation.
Joining us now is the leading theorist of these tectonic changes, Professor Glenn Deason of the University of Southeastern Norway and an author of a recent book on this very subject. Professor, good timing for the book. Tell me if you agree with me that what's happening in Ukraine is acting as a midwife. It's a very difficult labor into this new Eurasian era that you write about in your book.
Correct. Well, it's happening a bit faster than I had predicted. But, very briefly, I guess, since the early 1700s, so for the past 300 years, Russia's had a very Western-centric foreign policy. And ever since the Cold War came to an end, Russia's had this dream of a greater Europe based on Gorbachev's common European home. But this dream more or less collapsed in 2014 when the West backed this coup in Ukraine. And now so Russia began to seek to integrate its economy more towards the East, because for the first time now, China, non-Western power, is becoming the leading economy. So Russia's been trying to diversify its economic partners. And what we see now with these sanctions effectively burning all bridges, we see that Russia will now integrate far quicker in towards a more towards China and more Chinese-led international economic system.
There are perils, of course, for Russia, and I've heard you speak of them. Not so much perils, but potential obstacles in the way in the Eurasian sphere. Russia has good relations with India. China does not. Russia has relatively good relations with Japan. China does not. There are dangers, I suppose, of Russia becoming too much of a junior partner to China in this Eurasian sphere. How serious are these obstacles?
Well, China's obviously much more economically much more developed or powerful than Russia. But this doesn't necessarily have to be a problem if Russia diversifies its ties, because if it puts all its eggs in the Chinese basket, then it can be problematic that China is so much more powerful, because then this asymmetrical economic interdependence can be converted into political influence of China over Russia, so effectively drawing it in as a junior partner. However, as long as Russia diversifies partners, also works with Japan, India, South Korea, Iran, and most of the rest of the world, this could actually work as an advantage, as a balancer. And we've already seen this. I mean, the Japanese, the Indians, all of them have great incentives to develop closer economic ties with Russia for the specific reason they don't want Russia to become too dependent on China. This was something that the French and Germans also recognized. But for some reason, nothing was really done in terms of incentivizing some kind of a security arrangement in Europe. So we would have avoided conflicts such as this.
Well, you say for some reason, but what was the reason? On the face of it, it is a major failure of Western statecraft. Russia is not a communist country. China is. Russia is a white, European, Christian country, a democracy. Why couldn't the West accommodate it?
If Russia would be accommodated in Europe, there wouldn't be much purpose for NATO and the United States in Europe. So keeping, again, the Germans and the Russians at a distance, this has been a long goal by the UK and then by the United States. Again, when I say long, I mean over centuries now. So I think the main problem has been that over the past 30 years, we never really tried to accommodate Russia in a pan-European security agreement. Over the past 15 years, we kind of ignored all Russian warnings that absorbing Ukraine into NATO would become an existential threat. And then obviously since 2014, we similarly ignored very basic Russian demands for security. So again, we kind of pushed this idea in the West that NATO is not just the biggest military alliance in the world pointed against Russia, but it's just a club of democracies. And you know, NATO's just a defensive alliance, something we insist on even when we're bombing other countries from Yugoslavia to Libya. So I think over this time, we kind of, got a bit drowned in our own propaganda. It's important to understand how we got to this position. And I think, this failure accommodating the Russians is a big reason why. And this is why all economic ties are now being burned.
Professor, you said earlier that the changes of these tectonic plates is happening at a faster rate than you predicted. Now, is this because the East is rising faster or that the West is declining faster?
Well, I think it's both, which is why it's become a bit of a perfect storm for the West, because at the time when the pan-European security architecture is collapsing, it's the same time that China is emerging as an economic competitor to the United States. Now, these problems always, since the early 90s, people have been cautioning that this would be a possible consequence because as NATO expands to the east, this will have more and more threats towards Russia and also along the Russian border from Georgia, Moldova, Ukraine. They have very divided populations. If they're forced to choose between either the West or Russia, half of the population will have to be oppressed, and there's going to be a proxy war in these countries. So they kind of saw this conflict coming, and in 2014, they're going to realize that the dream of a common European home, that this was gone. So they slowly began to reduce reliance on Western industries, reduce reliance on Western technologies, reduce reliance on Western transportation corridors, their banks, different financial industries, the dollar as a currency, payment systems such as SWIFT. So developing all these alternatives. And where Russia doesn't have the capabilities, it cooperates with China. So again, this is why the strategic partnership with China has become so very important. And again, with these sanctions, they have to absorb a lot of pain and then adjust their economy, decouple it completely from the West. And I think many people in the West see this as kind of a victory, to see all this pain in Russia. But one has to remember that from now on, we will have no more influence in Russia. This will, all our economic influence there will now disappear. And we will only have military pressure in the future, which does not bode well for anyone.
Well, sometimes people struggle to lift a huge stone only to drop it on their own feet, of course. And that's in a way what Putin was saying just the other day when he said the US may come to regret using the dollar as a weapon of sanctions. Do you think he might be right?
Well, no, very much so. This is something that not just Russia, but China has been saying for a while. And one has to also remember that these sanctions put on Russia, now the Chinese are watching. They know that they're next in line, or they're at least seeing this as a case study for their own future conflicts with the United States. And before, in the past, it was only the dollar. You could be cut out of the dollar, you can be cut off SWIFT, but these days you can be cut off very important digital platforms, which are now laying the foundations of production. Effectively everything in society as we're entering this fourth industrial revolution. So I think that now now that we see that everything can be, all economic dependence can be used as an economic weapon, I think there is a huge interest now to simply decouple completely from the West and just learn to live without each other, which is, in my opinion, very sad developments.
I know you don't want to and don't justify war, but as you explain it, I've got to tell you that to me, Russia's action looks entirely rational in the circumstances. I don't need to go into what would happen if Russia and China put weapons in Mexico or Canada. I could talk about an independent Scotland with Russian weapons in it, pointing at London. But economically and geopolitically and economically, it looks to me like the Russian action is entirely rational, though they wish to paint it as mad.
Well, rational and legitimizing are, of course, two different things. And on the rational aspect, I agree. I mean, one doesn't have to condone something in order to say it's not that it's not rational. So this idea that you know, you can oppose a war, you can have two thoughts in the head at the same time. You can oppose the war and still recognize that Putin didn't just wake up one day in a bad mood, deciding to conquer new territory. I think it's important to recognize, like a lot of things that's often missed in the Western media, and one has to be able to acknowledge the background of these conflicts. So again, in 2014, the United States did remove the democratically elected President Yanukovych from power. We also saw that the U.S. backed the so-called anti-terrorist operation against Donbass. For now, 8 years, almost 4 million people have been living under siege, being bombed, with thousands of people killed. Again, the opposition leader has been arrested. Opposition media has been closed down. For 7 years, there's been no interest in implementing the Minsk agreement. And again, acknowledging this is necessary to understand how we got here. And so I think it's important to realize that this did not happen in a vacuum. But as I said, recognizing the rationality behind Russia is not the same as legitimizing it, of course. It's, just want to make that clear, because we have a bit of a hostile mood in the West at the moment.
Well, only 10% of the people of the world live in the so-called West. And as you powerfully make clear in your book, actually what is called the West is not just only 10% of the population of the world, but is itself peripheral. And if this Eurasian concept that you theorize comes to pass, what we know of as the West will very much be peripheral in the world.
Well, this is a problem when an economic hegemon declines, because it's more likely than to use its economic power over the international system as a weapon to prevent other powers from rising. But what we've seen now over the past few years, a lot of countries now are looking at, you know, what happens if we start to sanction the United States. So, you know, so you have Russia, China, Iran, and many other countries, for that sake, who's looking for alternative now. So they don't want to rely too much on American technologies, on their industries, on their transportation corridors, on the dollar, and on their banks. And effectively seeing this as a threat, that they don't want to be too vulnerable. And so you see now this incentive of all these Eurasian powers, they're seeking to cooperate more and more in the economic sphere. And this is, well, this will not bode well for the West. And I think also in terms of all these sanctions, I just want to make that point again, it's not just against Russia. A lot of other countries around the world are looking at this and realizing that they're willing to go to a huge extent. And before we pushed all the sanctions, perhaps we should have sat down for a while and thought about what would actually be the consequences. I mean, something simple as gas, all this cheap gas that Russia has been sending to Germany and the Europeans, making their energy cheap, making their industries competitive, all of this now will start to go more and more towards Asia. So the entire competitiveness of the world is shifting very quickly. And I think Europe will see it's and the U.S. its relative decline is speeding up. So this obviously these sanctions are not only hurting Russia; they're also hurting, as you mentioned, the peripheral West as well.
Smart people could have seen that coming, though, Professor. That seems to imply our leaders ain't very smart.
No, I agree. There's not much strategic thinking. I think we had some chance in 2014. You had 2016. I remember. Henry Kissinger went to Donald Trump after he got elected and gave him foreign policy advice, saying, "You know, listen, if we're going to continue to alienate the Russians, this is going to end very bad. We're going to hand over this huge power to a strategic partnership with China instead. Surely we should reconsider some of the decisions made in the 1990s in terms of trying to develop a Europe without Russia, which then becomes a Europe against Russia." But what happened? He was denounced as a Russian agent, and, well, we know the rest of the history. This is we haven't had the best leaders. There's not much strategic thinking. And obviously, in this horrible war we're watching, we see emotions running high and people making decisions when they're angry. They're usually not very good decisions at all.
Well, good luck with the book, Professor. Perfectly timed, I've got to say. Thanks for joining us on board the Sputnik.
Coming up next, the European perspective on the NATO-Russia war in the Ukraine. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to Sputnik. There's no longer a pretense in European countries, let alone North America, that this is not a NATO-Russia confrontation in Ukraine.
European countries in particular are stuffing mercenaries and high-tech weapons into a non-NATO country, resisting the very country that NATO was set up to confront. Full-scale economic warfare has been unleashed against Russia, whose minimal demands, in the words of Sergei Lavrov, have been rejected.
Joining us now from the heart of the European Union is writer and analyst Elijah Magnier. Elijah, thanks very much for joining us. In the beginning of this crisis, countries like Germany, France, didn't seem all that up for what has turned into a hell of a fight. But they're all in now. How did that happen?
Thank you for having me. I think this is the first time we see the European continent and European states so much involved in a war that is happening on the continent, but it's not its own war. We see for the first time also the European Union investing money on a third country that is not part of the European Union and the 27 European states, again, because they are forced to do so by the Americans, according to the Montreux Agreement 1823, that forces upon the Europeans not to contest or to adopt any policy that is not compatible with US policy. So we see how the Americans are pushing, first of all, Ukraine into a war that Ukraine could have solved the problem with Russia from day one. And we see there is no balance between the two forces. However, NATO and the United States behind it are putting all their effort in Ukraine to fight Russia on the Ukrainian soil.
Now, Emmanuel Macron made some attempts to help the situation and talk to President Putin, but he's not Charles de Gaulle, is he?
Well, indeed, you're really right. We see Emmanuel Macron in 2018 saying that Europe needs its own army to protect itself mainly against the United States of America. And then we hear Macron saying just a few weeks ago that we need a European army. So what France is saying, that is not General de Gaulle, rightly, that kicked out NATO in 1966, is saying that we have to stop this war because we don't want it. Actually, Russia is the main exporter of not only energy, but the whole lot of products to Europe. And it's Europe is shooting itself in the foot by considering Russia as an enemy or an opponent when it is not. So France is trying, and perhaps maybe Macron's sentence that Europe needs an army led to NATO being more aggressive and for the United States to interfere and drag Russia into a war on Ukrainian soil.
Germany is the biggest loser, though, isn't it? First of all, closer, but secondly, much more dependent on Russian gas. If Russia decides, as some reports say it already has, that actually they won't sell gas to Germany at any price, then a total economic and societal crisis then exists in Germany.
This is a very good question. Germany, we hear President Biden from Washington announcing the suspension of Nord Stream 2 in Germany. So it's Biden taking the decision on behalf of the Germans who are really in desperate need of gas. Now, first of all, Russia is supplying Germany with gas at a cheaper rate. Secondly, Germany and the rest of Europe is not equipped for liquefied gas that the United States wants to sell it to the European countries to give up on the Russian gas. And that means they need to rebuild station, they need to rebuild all kind of new infrastructure, and that takes years, like Holland said, exactly, Poland said the same, and Romania, other countries who depend on the Russian gas, including, surprisingly, Ukraine, that is still enjoying the Russian gas. And Germany is really in a desperate situation by being pushed by the Americans to stop this gas supply from Russia. And Russia is repeatedly saying, I am not weaponizing the energy. It's up to you to take it or not.
Well, the leaders of Europe proved willing in the end to adopt vassalage of Washington. What about the public? How kindly do you think they're going to look at the economic crisis and perhaps a banking crisis coming down the pipe also? Are they going to blame the Russians or are they going to blame their own leaders? And even if they blame the Russians, there's nothing they can do about the Russians, but they can do something about their own leaders.
Well, that's a very good question. Well, here there are two points. First of all, the European leaders have really no say at the end of the day to stop or continue the war. Secondly, what we are observing here is the end of the institutions and laws. What we see from the United States that is violating every single article of the international law, invading countries and setting the example that we're living in a really the jungle law. And by living in a jungle law, every single country around the world can say, okay, well, I feel uncomfortable with what this country or that country is doing, then I'm going to do exactly what the United States is doing. The problem we're facing is a very harsh, aggressive, worldwide mainstream media propaganda and misinformation about what is the real origin of this war. Everybody trying in the mainstream media to divert the public opinion about the real problem behind this war, that are, again, the U.S. promises in 1990, 1993, through U.S. Secretary James Baker, 1990 to Gorbachev, and 1993, Warren Christopher to President Yeltsin, because they say it is not a written agreement. Fine. If we go to written agreement, we can recall upon the 2015 JCPOA that has not been respected neither by the US nor by Europe. So what kind of agreement is valid? There is no accountability, and we're not giving any way to the United Nations. It is time for a new world order.
Well, I'm glad you alluded to the point. I was in Parliament, one of a very few who opposed the war on Yugoslavia, and pointed out later that the recognition of the unilateral declaration of independence of Kosovo would, of course, be replicated in other places in the world. I sometimes wonder, because it's my predisposition to believe we're ruled by knaves, but perhaps we're ruled by fools.
Indeed, you mentioned the former Yugoslavia. I covered the war on the ground in the former Yugoslavia. I was in Sarajevo, Croatia, etc. And I've seen what the Americans have done by depriving the European from the decision to stop that war that was happening in the heart of Europe. Today, we have another war that is happening again in the European continent. And again, the Europeans don't have a say. It means either our leaders in Europe are fool or pretend to be fool or really have no power, then they need to move away. So we can't see the European states dragged into a war they don't want. It is against their own policy, against their own interest. We see everything. The prices are rising every single day of everything. It's becoming unaffordable. I heard France Minister 2 days ago saying that this is going to cost us $17 billion, and we hope that the war will end in June. And then why are we not doing anything to stop it? Because we are powerless and because we are spineless.
The bonfire, of course, is not just of money, but of liberties. You must be struck on the European mainland, as we certainly are here, by the ease with which all the lipstick of civil society, liberalism, and all of that has just been wiped off. There's no pretense that there's any freedom to speak anymore. We are only allowed to receive official information. Journalism has gone quietly into that good night.
Unfortunately, we're starting to feel a bit of shame for being called journalists because of the journalism today. But this hasn't started in 2022, George. It has started also in previous wars. We've seen what happened in Syria. Anyone who's saying anything about the reality on the ground is either an Assad apologist, and today it is a Putin apologist. So saying the truth is very costly today, and we see how the social media are behaving, setting the example of you can say, I wish Putin is killed, but you can't say, how would you like him to be killed? This is really ridiculous.
Well, Facebook is now allowing you to call for the killing, not just of Putin, but of Russians, signed by Nick Clegg, the Liberal Democrat, former Deputy Prime Minister of Britain. Of course, one has to pay a cost when one makes a stand that is against the prevailing orthodoxy. I'm ready to pay that cost. What I object to is not to be allowed to speak at all, to be literally swept out of the public square.
Well, anyone today who's saying something that disagrees with the mainstream media and the rhetoric and the narrative that Putin is demonized and they're canceling even Tchaikovsky's play. I mean, we've reached a limit where it is the level of ignorance is dominance, and it's better not to speak because we don't want to be contaminated.
Elijah Magni, thanks for joining us on board the Sputnik. Well, alas, that means it's the end of the show.
But you can still stay in touch with us on our social media. On Twitter and Instagram, it's RT_Sputnik. On Facebook, Sputnik on Russia Today. It's goodbye from me, Gayatri.
And from me, George Galloway. It's been marvelous.